Penguin Random House Audio presents The Distance Home by Paula Saunders. Read for you by Rebecca Lohman. It is hard to follow one great vision in this world of darkness and of many changing shadows. Among those shadows, men get lost. But anywhere is the center of the world. Black Elk, as quoted by John G. Neihardt in Black Elk Speaks. Part 1. Chapter 1. The End, a Refrain. "It's you or me next," Renee said to get a laugh. Her brother had already passed away, as had her father. Now, Renee and her sister were once again driving the length of the state. Black cattle dotted the yellow hillsides. Out their open windows, long abandoned homesteads flew by, roofs pitched eerily to one side, windmills cracked in half, groaning. With this one more passing, it was down to just the two of them. Mostly, Renee had been steely, while Jane had been unable to stop crying. Renee was older, but it didn't matter how old they were. Their mother had finally stopped messing the bed and tearing her clothes off in the middle of the night, ending up naked and haywire on the mattress or sprawled, drooling on the carpet next to it, her translucent body shimmering with sweat. She'd lain unconscious for the final week, cold and luminous as porcelain, as the girls came in to handle her by hip bones and shoulder blades, to turn her this way and that. They would bury her ashes next to their father's and brother's. They'd been busy, cleaned and sold her house, divided everything without jealousy or rancor. In so many ways, it was all done. And in so many ways, it was just beginning. "You girls will miss her," someone had said at the service. "No one in the world can love you like your mother does." Renee had nodded and smiled coolly, dismissing the sentiment as tired and trite, while Jane reached for a tissue. "Thank you for coming," Renee had said. She'd found herself repeating the same line all morning, as if by rote, wondering if it was the right thing to say, or if perhaps there was something fundamentally cold and incorrect about her that was causing her to sound standoffish and transparently unfeeling. Chapter 2. Eve. Yvonne, called Eve, grew up around the corner and down the long dirt road from Al, two houses from the muddy banks of the Bad River, just where it joined with the Missouri, so there was always the problem of flood and river smell. On wash day, she and her mother would change the sheets, moving top sheet to bottom because it hadn't been too badly used, then bottom sheet to the wash tub, through the wringer and out onto the line, where the wind was kicking up dirt and chicken scat. Despite the sunburnt yard, the pile of old tractor tires, the chickens underfoot, and the yellow haze that rose around the confluence of the two rivers, Eve never considered herself a country girl. She was just on the wrong side of the Missouri. Across the water, in Pierre, the state capital, were the politicians and doctors, the green lawns with walkways and trimmed hedges. On her side, in Old Fort Pierre, were the bars, the yards full of chickens and stray cats, the overgrown lots, thick with snakes and broken-down cars, and on the hill as you were coming down into town, a plaque indicating a stop on the Lewis and Clark expedition. She knew from the beginning she'd have to have grit, have to make her own way. So she'd come up with a plan to apply to the South Dakota College of Business to be an executive secretary, a professional girl. Then the uniformed men had arrived at her door, holding their hats like dinner plates, to say that her eldest brother, Buddy, had been killed by a landmine in Germany on his way home, the war already won. And not 2 weeks later, as the house was still reeling in grief, her mother still laid up in bed, her baby brother, Tom, the skinny little six-year-old Eve was mostly raising herself, combing his hair for school and yelling for him to get in out of the rain, drowned in the dried-up Bad River, disappearing into a sinkhole so deep that no one was ever able to recover his remains. And suddenly, at 17, Eve was weary. She was tired of watching her little sister, Fanny, flirt with the priests, lifting her skirt at every town dance to show off her raggedy underthings, making an ass of herself, and tired of seeing her mother, a woman who'd never sat down in all her life, stunned and speechless with grief, first unable to rise from her bed, then unwilling to get up from her chair, her once auburn hair a shock of white, her strong, steady hands taken with uncontrollable tremors. And her father, who after a day or two of stumbling through the house as if blind, simply went back to work, an invisible weight pressing him forward, bending his spine, so that each day seemed to set him a little closer to the earth. So Eve finalized the year's last edition of the school newspaper, wrote the class remembrances for the yearbook, finished her run as lead in the senior play, graduated valedictorian from Fort Pierre High School, and made up her mind to marry Al from up the street, as he'd been asking her to do. When her folks refused to grant permission for her to marry him ahead of legal age, she bit her tongue and set her wedding for the day of her 18th birthday. Al was tall, with glossy black curls, fine cowboy boots, and a smile big enough to make the town girls blush and call him Pretty Boy. But it wasn't just his looks that spoke to Eve. Al had a dignity, an elegance, a quality of floating above that captured her attention and seemed to match her idea of what was right. Plus, he had a red and white convertible, a sweet green motorboat on a tow in the driveway, and his folks had the nicest house this side of the Missouri, stately, with fieldstone pillars, fresh white paint, and a wraparound porch overlooking Deadwood Street, the only paved, tree-lined thoroughfare in town. He'd been in the service, training as a bombardier in North Carolina when Germany surrendered and the boys started coming home. And during all his time away, he told Eve, he'd been thinking about her, about how she had the greatest legs in town. So when he got back to Fort Pierre, he came straight to the cafe where she was working after school. He'd come in during her breaks just to sit with her in a booth and help her refill ketchup bottles and salt shakers, occasionally wrapping his feet around her slim ankles or letting a hand fall under the table to graze her firm, bare calves. He'd even loiter all through the dinner service just to walk her home. They went on picnics, they went on boat rides, they dressed up in their best clothes and went out to the movies, and in no time, they fell in love. So Eve and Al were married with both a wedding cake and a birthday cake, her old dad walking her down the aisle with his mouth pulled into a crescent moon frown. Then Eve leaned out the window of Al's new pickup for a photo, tossed her bouquet, and they took off for Chicago. And just a week later, they came back and moved in with Al's parents, occupying the little basement apartment, not taking the least notice of his mother's heavy tread above them. Still, it wasn't lost on Eve that whenever they happened to speak, her new mother-in-law, Emma, who'd known her since Eve was a tow-headed tomboy running the streets in her brother's hand-me-down overalls, climbing trees and throwing stones down by the Bad River, would now feign visible shock at her presence, unfailingly turning her head away and sniffing as though she'd just smelled something vinegary. Most likely, Emma was...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?